Did you know you could sponsor Nerd and Tie? Just go to GoFundMe.com/Nerd and Tie and please give to our legal defense fund. Help us protect our First Amendment rights. On this episode of Nerd and Tie, Ron Glass has sadly passed away. Brian Fuller will have no active role with Star Trek Discovery. Lin-Manuel Miranda is producing the King Collar Chronicle adaptation. Is the convention bubble over or breaking? And Twin Cities Geek is running a charity drive. We talk about all of that, plus your mailbag letters, on this episode of Nerd and Tie. And welcome to Nerd and Tie.
Hi, guys.
The only podcast on the internet with a dress code. I am one of your co-hosts, the very tall Trey Dorn. Joining me, as always, are the wondiferous Nick Izumi.
How's everybody doing this fine Fortnite?
He's been wondiferous two episodes in a row.
He's wondiferous every time I introduce him. And being announced last because he's leaving at the end of the year, the temporary firsters.
I am temporarily here. I am here for this episode and the next one, and then I'm going to regenerate into somebody else.
Yes. Or we'll try to get whoever we replace you with on an episode with you still here. I mean, that's... Yeah. I don't know.
And then they got to kill me on air.
I don't know.
I thought
your last episode was January 1st.
Oh, would that... Do we have a show on New Year's Day?
Yeah, that's going to be the year in review episode.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, whatever that ends up being.
Yeah. So Fur's last episode will technically be in 2017. So
yes.
If for awards nominations, he will be eligible.
Yes.
Indeed.
You know, all those many awards that we are, of course, always constantly winning as a podcast.
It'll be great. I mean, I'll get a Pulitzer for my performance on this last episode. Like Edward Murrow will have like nothing on me for this last episode.
All I know about award shows in this past few months is that I can now say Nobel laureate Bob Dylan. And I'm never going to describe Nobel laureate Bob Dylan as anything less. From here on out, it's always going to be Nobel laureate Bob Dylan.
But what would Nobel laureate Bob Dylan say about that?
He would say, "Dancing boy in a Chinese suit, he looked at me, I took his flute, though that wasn't very cute, was I?" That is a direct quote from Nobel laureate Bob Dylan.
Or something, or he would say something like that, but he would say, "In a Chinese boy in a..." Suit in here. Wasn't funny. How does it feel
about the hurricane? Oh.
He has a Nobel Prize now. I'm legitimately happy about this, but I'm never going to describe him as anything less.
Poetically speaking, he's genius.
However, do not take any linguistic dictation courses from him. Or, oh my God. You ever do that thing where your brain blanks about a word? Enunciation. Enunciation is what I wanted to say, but my brain completely blanked. This is what happened to Thanksgiving, like, in the middle. And, you know, and this week has been especially tough for me because I had a tooth ripped out of my head.
Oh God, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, and we learned one thing at the dentist, and that is my teeth really do not want to leave my head.
They are there to stay.
I had a wisdom tooth pulled recently, so I feel for you.
Yeah, well, I shattered a tooth, and I'm going to need an implant, but it's going to be months before they can put that in. But
I haven't had to have any major medical procedures in the last 2 years, so
well,
I can't.
It's wait till you hit your 30 and your teeth start breaking. It's years of soda drinking catch up to you, my man. It is not fun. And popcorn's the enemy.
You shattered it on popcorn?
Well, not this one. I've shattered two teeth on popcorn.
Oh, jeez.
Dear
man.
God.
One while seeing the second Hunger Games movie.
You probably shouldn't mix gravel in with your popcorn kernels. They don't pop.
No, it's I've broken I have now broken 3 teeth, not including the wisdom tooth I broke years ago, but since that got extracted, I forget about my wisdom teeth. No, it's and 2 of them had more than enough tooth left to put a crown on. So like I've got a gold tooth in the back of my mouth. It's shiny. Oh,
good information to have. How many ounces would you say the tooth is, Trey?
Oh dear Lord. Well, you know, now that we've talked about dental, oh my God, so we need to start going into our first story, which is a sad one, unfortunately. And
yeah,
making jokes about stealing my teeth just doesn't seem like the right way to go into it, but this is
it's what we're stuck with, so we better keep moving.
Yeah, between these two episodes, effectively halfway between last episode and this episode, about just over a week ago, actor Ron Glass, best known to generations, a generation of nerds as Shepard Book on Firefly and Serenity, sadly passed away just over a week ago on the Black Friday. And he passed away due to respiratory failure. He was 71 years old. Besides working on Firefly, he's best known to audiences for his role on the series Barney Miller. He actually, for a really long time, had talked, you know, thought negatively about science fiction until doing an appearance on Star Trek Voyager, which got him to change his mind, and that's why he eventually auditioned for Firefly. And he was 71 years old. He was a talented actor, and he will be missed.
No, I mean, you look at his filmography and what he has done for TV. I mean, he's been in. When did he get started? He was active since 1972.
Yeah,
and only recently left in 2014. I mean, he did everything. He did voice acting. He did live action.
Last thing I saw him in was Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, he was on the pilot episode. I mean, a wide range of genre work that he did, including...
I forgot he was in S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, he was the
No, I remember now, but I forgot episode, yeah. For a little bit. That's embarrassing.
And including the short-lived remake that I was really a fan of the new Odd Couple. It aired for 1 year. He played Felix in a remake.
Really?
The
there was another remake? I mean, obviously there's a currently running remake. With Tom Lennon and
in the 80s they did like an all African American cast of The Odd Couple.
Crazy.
Yeah, and he was Felix in it, which
yeah, I could see him pulling that off. Yeah. I might just look that up.
It's not bad. I mean, like I said, it only lasted a season.
1982 to 1983. Yeah.
Okay, it was early 80s.
Yeah.
But I mean, that was pretty cool.
Ron
and,
Glass,
and he,
Desmond Wilson.
He has such a wide range of stuff. But and it's sad to see him go. But I got to say one thing, guys, to our listeners out there. Like, when somebody dies, your first response should not be, well, I guess we're not going to get this now, because I can't tell you how many people I saw respond to the news of his death with, well, there goes the last chance at a Firefly reboot.
Everyone needs to shut up about a Firefly reboot anyway. The show is over.
Serenity was the perfect bookend to that series. It was a wonderful movie. I loved it, and his character died in it.
The show is over. It's been over.
It wouldn't have been any good after that.
Most of the cast don't want to do more.
Well, Nathan Fillion does, but...
So, yeah, guys, when somebody dies, don't think about, well, how does this affect my wants for things?
Yeah.
Like, don't.
That's gross.
God.
Like, I saw that so much on Facebook, and I wanted to just respond to everybody with, like, do you feel that way about every time somebody dies? Like when somebody dies, do you immediately think, well, I guess I'm not going to get this from them? Like, what?
Oh, that's gross.
Shame on all of you that did that.
It's really gross. Sorry. I'm not sorry. It's just gross.
Yeah.
So
it's sadly, Ron Glass, talented actor, no longer with us.
Go watch Barney Miller. It was freaking awesome.
Or just go ahead and rewatch Firefly like 20 times.
And so he will and should be missed.
Yeah.
He was great.
I mean, that's just a thing you should do on like a Tuesday is rewatch all of Firefly, right? I mean, I'm not crazy.
Doable. Yeah.
Speaking as someone who was very active in the lending people the DVDs at when it came out, and
oh, so it's your fault.
Yeah, I'm like a reformed Firefly evangelist at this point, because there was a while where I just wanted more people to see this show that I loved, and now I'm actually at that point where I'm like, okay, you guys, it was good. It wasn't as good as you're saying it was.
I think it was, but only because it got canceled. It's honestly, like, you look at the season two stuff that Joss Whedon wanted to do, and actually I'm glad
and
a lot of it didn't happen. Yeah,
it's
and
legitimately
so
awful.
So that's why I think that I think that we got kind of the best. Yeah, it's I didn't watch it when it first aired because I was a Farscape fan. It was in the same time slot, and
I did. It when it first aired because I'm just that
well
hipster.
I also no it's because I went out on Friday nights. I was in my 20s. I went out Friday nights and I can only tape one show, like, and so
I was in middle school and I had no friends, so yeah.
I can only tape one show because this is in the age of VCRs, and you know, couldn't like illegally stream stuff back then. Like, that's how bad it was. You know, it's not that, like, it's not just that there wasn't a legal streaming service to make it easy to watch it. There wasn't an illegal way to do it easily back then because, you know, the internet was, you know, like, there were ways to steal video on the internet in, like, the early 2000s, but not really any good ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would record Farscape and whatever show Sci-Fi had running at the same time, and then I didn't watch it. But Nerd and Tie listener Kyle The Rock Johnson, as I long ago swore that if I ever said his full name, I would be adding that in. He lent me his DVDs of Firefly a couple years after the show aired. And I, like, obviously fell in love, and I got my own copy of it, and, you know, but...
Yeah, not to sound like such a whiner, but yeah, that's the point I've gotten to, is I kind of regret being a Firefly evangelist.
I don't think you should. I think it does stand as a single season of one of the greatest science fiction television series ever produced. It is...
Yeah, it's fair.
It never went off the rails, and I think that's good. And then because it concludes with a film, which ties up enough of the stories from the series, I feel like you're left with a complete thing. And so
I agree with that.
And so it's, I don't want more Firefly. I want to be clear. I love Firefly. I love every episode that aired, and I love that movie Serenity. I don't want any more. Like, that's perfect. I mean, frankly, I just also don't want to fund Adam Baldwin ever again.
Yeah, no.
That too, yeah.
He's a
I stopped watching The Last Ship. I mean, it was a terrible it's a terrible show, The Last Ship, but I also stopped watching it because it was a terrible show and Adam Baldwin was on it, so. Because I'll watch bad shows. Try to stop
Adam Baldwin's entitled to his opinion, but we're all entitled to tell him, you're stupid, Adam Baldwin.
And I don't want to give Adam Baldwin any more money. I used to cosplay as one of his characters, goddammit. Now I feel gross.
Who did you...
I have a Jane hat. I've got a...
Oh.
I've done...
I didn't see it.
There are photos of me on Facebook in a Jane costume.
Oh.
I can see it.
Like, dancing with, like, Sam in a banana costume.
Oh.
It's a weird world, man.
Yeah, no kidding. Huh.
Anyways.
So anyway, as we started, Ron Glass.
So, okay, so you know what, though? Like, we should probably move on.
How did we go from scolding people for having nerd rage to actually having nerd rage? Now I feel bad.
It all.
I don't have
all,
nerd rage.
We are the snake. We are Ouroboros, guys.
The snake, it eats itself. Yes. That's Nerdentai's other motto. But speaking of science fiction series that no one's gonna watch, but we're really excited for.
Yeah. So a couple of months ago, we reported on this. Actually, not even a couple of months ago. 1 month ago, at the end of October, we reported on the story that Brian Fuller, the then showrunner of Star Trek Discovery, was stepping away from the show because of all of his other projects that he had, but that he would still probably be involved in the writing, et cetera, et cetera. Well, over the last couple of days, it has come out that Brian Fuller is now actually splitting from the show entirely and will have no involvement beyond the first season. Of course, Brian Fuller did write some of the episodes for Star Trek Discovery, as well as having a hand in the whole story arc of season one. But he is not going to be there for it, and he will not be there for anything after season one.
Well, we don't know what's going to happen after season one.
We don't even know if they're going to get a season two.
Yeah, it's
the way they're going to air it.
Yeah, it's let's unpack this, because the announcement was is that Brian Fuller is no longer actively involved in the show. That's what he confirmed, and it's because obviously, you know, he wrote the first two episodes, and he wrote the outline that they're going to be building the entire season off of. So he effectively wrote the plot that they're using. It's just that he's no longer going to be adding, contributing anymore. And we know that his replacements of showrunners are people who work closely with his vision and will probably execute something very similar to what we would have seen if he had been there. So let's be clear about both of those points. And as for season two, Fuller has stated that if they asked for him back for season two, he would be there in a heartbeat. So it's really what happened here is that, and I know that a whole bunch of people on the internet are freaking out about, oh, Brian Fuller's going to be gone completely, and they were all freaking out when we first heard the announcement, but this is what happened. Star Trek Discovery was originally supposed to come out in January. Brian Fuller said he needed more time, so the network delayed it till May. All right, and that's a huge, that's 5 months of production that they delayed that. What happened was, and this seems to be what happened, is that Brian Fuller asked for the network to delay it a second time, and they said no. It's, frankly, they don't want to delay the show effectively. I mean, a second delay would put it probably in the late fall, which puts it on a whole other cycle, pretty much almost delaying it for a year in the television world, if they delayed it again. It would effectively be delayed a year from its original release date, which is just, in the TV world, you can't do that. Their promotional cycles, like, they are relying on this show to launch the CBS All Access, like, to a larger audience. And so to say that they have to put it off another two financial quarters for the showrunner, it's obviously the network's going to, like, not be willing to keep delaying with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's,
that makes a lot of sense, especially too, if you look at what Brian Fuller is working on right now. I mean, he really wants to focus and make sure that American Gods is good. And we all want American Gods to be really good. So I can't say we all blame him for wanting to take that and make that his focus right now.
But you know what? Lord knows. Like, this whole thing is, it's like people talking about how great it would be with Brian Fuller, but helming a Star Trek series is a full-time job. It's not a part-time
job. Oh, absolutely.
Rick Berman wasn't doing five other things when he was running, you know, besides like multiple Star Trek shows, like in the 90s. I love Brian Fuller. I think he's a great showrunner, and I'm super hyped about American Gods because I'm a huge fan of that novel. And with, you know, like, I think the casting is spot on. Like, it's everyone either looks exactly like what I had in my head, or they look, you know, close enough to like the same text that, you know, that I'm really happy with all. Like, either someone's such a good actor that I don't mind that they don't look exactly right in my head, or they look exactly right in my, like, as the person did in my head. So I'm super excited about that show. But the fact is that Star Trek is, it's a thing. It's like, it, you can't half-ass it. And I feel like if, you know, if, to do a true show with a showrunner that pulled apart, it was going to, like, it was going to be like Sherlock.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like, Sherlock kept getting delayed, not because of the, just because of the stars, but because Moffat was doing that and Doctor Who at the same time. And, mm-hmm. you know, as much as, you know, Doctor Who has been a mixed bag from Moffat, you know, Sherlock's been good the entire time. But the fact is that, you know, he, is, you know, when everyone on the production side is pulled in multiple directions, it delays the content. And we don't want to get a new season of Star Trek every 2 years.
Yeah, that's just unreasonable.
And so, yeah.
I'm still shocked that they can get away with that with Sherlock, with how rabid the fan base is.
Well, they've learned less is more. It's eventually they'll put out the amount of content that a whole season of Firefly had, and then they'll run out of ideas. Like, that's the genius of Sherlock, though, right? Like, it's... Look, I'm a fan of... Look, I love... Okay, so I haven't been... I'm a season behind on Elementary, but... Because I've been catching up the season after on Hulu. Because obviously I'm not going to pay for CBS All Access until this Star Trek show comes out. It's, you know, and both adaptations are very different. But the fact is that the Sherlock adaptation has... I'm not saying it's perfect. There are a couple of problematic moments in the series. I'm not going to deny that. But the fact is that they put out really good content... But they put out so little content that it does. There's no filler. While on the other hand, like the Elementary series, which I love, by the way, I think it's actually a really good. They're both legitimate interpretations of modernizing Sherlock Holmes, and they did it in different ways.
I haven't seen much of it, but I like what I've seen.
I love Lucy Liu Watson.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, she's so great. And there is... Okay, so, by the way, there's, like, less physical chemistry between Lucy Liu Watson... Lucy Liu Watson and Johnny Lee Miller's Sherlock Holmes have a much more believable platonic relationship than Martin Freeman's Watson and Benedict Cumberbatch. Because I watched Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman's, and I'm like, those two were banging so hard. Like, but it's, you know... So I guess what it comes down to is that I know a Brian Fuller ran Star Trek Discovery would have been phenomenal, but I think it'll be pretty damn good without him, using just his outline. And I hope that if the show gets renewed for a second season, he comes back.
Indeed.
I'm really excited about this, about Discovery.
I'm more excited for American Gods.
See, I'm excited for... one of the reasons I'm excited for Discovery was actually not that long ago. I was thinking to myself, where's Michelle Yeoh? What has she been doing recently?
Yeah.
I would love to see her in something.
Yeah,
and then suddenly she popped up as the captain. I'm like, wow, yay.
Yeah. Although she's not going to be the central character, because the central character was specifically not the captain.
I was going to say, they confirmed
Michelle
Yeoh's going to
be in something again.
I know.
Which has me excited.
Yeah, Michelle Yeoh's going to be the captain of Discovery. And
no,
finally,
like, it's hilarious. I was just thinking about the fact that I haven't seen her in anything in a while, and that made me really frustrated. And then I was like,
finally,
oh.
We get a captain who's not Janeway, who's a woman. I mean, mm-hmm. Obviously, there have been background captains, like, and minor characters who are women who are captains on Star Trek, but not like a series header. You know, it's, you know, it, like the captain. You know, not a captain, the yeah. captain,
or an admiral. Because I think in Next Generation, one of the admirals is a woman, right?
Oh yeah, no, they've had woman admirals,
yeah,
in
several.
Next Generation, in the
was there
in the
one
movies.
In the original series?
Oh, in the original, not so much.
Okay, I didn't think so.
You know what? I'm gonna have to look.
Yeah, I'm like on my way to do that too.
At least, I don't think Starfleet ever did. There was the only female captain I remember in Trek was actually the Romulan captain I can't even remember the name of the episode, but it was an episode set in the neutral zone, and I really liked it. And they were really cheap that episode, so they didn't actually like build new Romulan ships. They just used Klingon ships and said and had a throwaway line about how the Romulans are using Klingon ships now. That's kind of cool.
Let's see here. I wonder if there's a. Let me find.
Oh, I guess in the cage in the menagerie, there was a woman commanding Enterprise.
No, that was the first officer.
That's the first officer. That's number one.
Oh.
Barrett's original character.
Yeah, that's number one. The character has no other name besides number one. Let's see here. Admiral.
I got nothing. I can't not a quick search anyway.
All right, let me see here.
I'm sure there's like somebody out there right now listening or will be listening and like,
well the real question is that there are a couple episodes where you have a table full of admirals. And so
binders full of admirals.
Whether or not any of them like Starfleet Vice Admirals. Let me see here. I don't want Catherine Jamie. It is Next Generation.
Now, we recently had Admiral Paris in Beyond.
That is Next Generation. Well, yeah, I think technically she was a Commodore.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
But she was making the decision for a vice admiralcy. That was a really confusing, like, situation because she was apparently part of the review board for a promotion that would be higher than her. Because Commodores are rear admirals. Like, it's the same rank. It just gets renamed later. Between the original series and Next Generation, Commodores got replaced with rear admirals because the Navy switched to rear admirals. In real life. Yeah, I don't know if we saw any women admirals in the original series. If we did, it wasn't a major role. So I'm just gonna. Yeah, it's.
Yeah, who knows.
Well, there aren't a lot of admirals in the original series, so that's why it's
hard to tell.
Like, I know there's an admiral in The Trouble with Tribbles, but there are a couple other times, and I just cannot remember. I think that we're all, I'm literally sitting here Googling through stuff, and it's been so long since I watched the original series that I can't, I can remember specific women admirals from Next Gen and later. But yeah, no, it's so yeah. Brian Fuller will have no active role with Star Trek Discovery.
Yes, to come back to the original point,
which is unfortunate. But you know what? Not everything in TV is dire, or film, or TV and film. Isn't that right, Nick?
Oh yeah. Well, there's a story that I've been following decently closely, and Trey did a nice write up on it on the website. Lionsgate, a while back, approached Stevens Point local author Patrick Rothfuss about adapting his epic fantasy novel series, which as of right now, still doesn't have its finale out, the Kingkiller Chronicle. Waiting patiently for part three, Mr. Rothfuss.
I'm literally holding a copy of The Name of the Wind.
It was announced that Pat Rothfuss had indeed cut some type of a deal with Lionsgate to do an adaptation of his epic fantasy series. Well, we now have a producer attached to it, and holy cats, this is a really cool one. Lin-Manuel Miranda, the mastermind behind the mega hit Hamilton, is going to be stepping out as the main producer for the King Killer Chronicle adaptation, which is going to start with a film adaptation of Rothfuss's first book, The Name of the Wind, and is going to be continued and fleshed out in a TV series, which, again, this is just so cool. The Name of the Wind film will be written by Lindsay Beer, and no word on, no word on who's doing any of the writing for the show yet, but
we do have producers.
Yeah, we got producers working on the film side. You've got Jae-yoon. Excuse me if I'm mispronouncing this. Jae-yoon Choi Mumford and Naoki Raichu-huri. Pardon me, if I definitely mispronounced that. I'm sorry about that. Are going to be working on the film. Chris Selleck and Andy Richley are going to be working on the TV end. And Richard Lawrence is helping to produce both the films and the TV show. I'm excited for this.
That's a stacked production crew.
So, yeah, it's Lin-Manuel Miranda. Lin-Manuel Miranda is going to be doing be a producer for both the movie and the TV series. He's going to be composing the music for the movie and TV series, and
the music is very central
yeah.
to the story. If
yeah.
you guys, if you're not familiar with Name of the Wind or the rest of Rothfuss universe, yeah, the music is very central to who your main character Koth is.
Yeah.
So,
and also, and this is my favorite part, and it's just a contract writer. It's not like a thing that anyone really has any plans for, but Miranda will also have the rights. He is required to be involved in any stage adaptations of the material that might happen down the line. So if there's ever anything for the King Killer Chronicle put on stage, Lin-Manuel Miranda has to be involved.
That's
so
cool.
Yeah, it's I think
this is shaping up to be really neat.
I mean, it's true. Like, Lin-Manuel Miranda, he wrote and starred in Hamilton and In the Heights, but he also rapped with House in that one episode in the, when he checked himself into a mental hospital in that couple episodes. He did rap with House, and he did make me watch Hugh Laurie badly rap, and so I do blame Lin-Manuel Miranda for that.
You know what? I think all of that is forgivable compared to the work for good that he has been doing. Oh my God!
I think it kind of right now it's a balanced scale. So, and also he was one of the main composers on Moana.
Hmm.
Yeah, he's gonna be going for
which I have
going
not
for an
seen
EGOT
yet.
EGOT this year.
Well, it's
dude's
the
magic touch.
The funny thing is that the funny thing about the Moana thing is apparently people kept asking Disney how they got Lin-Manuel Miranda to like be one of the composers in the thing, but they got him before Hamilton premiered. Like, he was working on the show, like he was writing stuff for Moana with, like, collaborating with the other composers, like, before Hamilton, like, while he was also writing Hamilton. So, like, they're like, you know, it was easy to get when he was just the guy who did In the Heights.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, to be fair, a very good show. Also, you know, he won his first Tony for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited about the adaptation of King Killer Chronicle. It's very ambitious and very similar to what I think Ron Howard wanted to do with The Dark Tower about like a decade ago.
It's really interesting because that book is so dense and so much happens in it. And
yeah, and so I think it's an ambitious project, which is going to be like Lionsgate. Like, on the one hand, I'm really glad it's happening this way, but on the other hand, it's a huge risk, because what happens if the TV show gets canceled, but they had planned on filling in some holes for, like, the second movie from the TV show? What if Pat never finishes the third book?
That's... Oh, fair one. for me because I really.
He's going to be helping write the show. He's going to be helping do the stuff for the show. And so, like,
we've seen what happens to that when George R.R. Martin gets involved. Pat Roth is, don't be the next George R.R. Martin.
In more ways than one.
Oh, Pat. I met you once at Daisho Con many years ago.
Hey, for what it's worth, you definitely don't have to worry about Pat Rothfuss being the next George R. Martin in one regard. He was actually one of the advisors to the Women's Resource Center at UWSP.
So the funny thing is like the one time I met Pat Rothfuss, I feel like it was such a like missed opportunity on my part because it was like within a year of the first book coming out and like no one knew who he was.
It's amazing.
Like, I didn't know who he was. And like, so like, I totally like blew off this chance to have this like meaningful, like I just walked out of the room. Cause I think I was like Happy Wednesday was performing at that Daisho Con. Like, so I was also like, I was as equally famous a guest at that point.
I will never, in terms of just my history with Pat Rothfuss, I never had the pleasure of taking a class with him. But as people may know, I went to UWSP when he was a professor there. And I got to talk to him. I got to hear a couple of his lectures. He was a very friendly and very active part of the Stevens Point community.
If I'd have been smart, I would have become like best friends with this guy.
Oh, he was just like,
but no, I totally didn't talk to him.
For the longest time, like when I was up there, any time that I went to a midnight premiere of one of the Marvel movies, you could pretty much guarantee he was there. One of my last memories from going to school at UWSP was when I went to go see Avengers opening night, and there was Pat Rothfuss in the line with us. And I was with some friends, and they waved him over, and they said hi, and they're like, Pat, you mark our words. We're going to be out here in this line when your book ever gets a movie. And we'll be selling the bootlegs of your book out here.
And lo and behold, they may get that chance.
I may have to print some bootlegs of Name of the Wind and be outside of Stevens Point Theater in the next couple of years. Just... if I'm going to keep that promise, darn it.
Oof. That's just,
he's just a great guy and he's a great writer and I cannot wait to see how this comes out.
God. Yeah. So it's, I'm excited about this. I am kicking myself for not having like bothered to like, it's just another book author. Who's like self,
and then like, he becomes like the biggest rock star of the new community.
You have to understand that if you do enough cons, you've seen enough people promoting their books where like even some of the ones who are professionally published, they're never going to be famous. They're never going to be huge. They haven't written the next big thing. They just wrote a thing. And so, you know, you're perfectly polite to him. You're nice to him. Maybe even become like now I'm like anytime I meet an author who seems at all comp, you know, like, capable, I'm like, let's be best friends on Facebook. And like when one of you guys blows up, I'm gonna be right there. I swear. I'm like, oh, because you know you can't ride anyone's coattails if they don't know who you are.
True facts.
You know, it's like...
isn't that right, cast of Famicom Dojo podcast? Also, J.L. Westover of Mr. Lovenstein.
I used to live in... I used to live in the same house as Sean Corse. I don't know, like... I don't know. Hey, and I started a long-running anime convention with Kevin Tambernino of Famicom Dojo. We performed on stage together in very uncomfortable costumes. His was more uncomfortable than mine.
He told me to watch Evangelion when I was 13.
No, it's... Sean and Kevin will always be just slightly more famous than us, and that's what's going to happen.
It wasn't at a convention either. It was at Boy Scout camp.
Wisconsin's a crazy place to be a fan of things. Pro tip, move to Wisconsin.
Up. It's a really small world up here.
No, it's like you get to this point where like everyone like no like they talk about it, the whole world is like 6 degrees. In Wisconsin, everyone's 2 degrees. It's like just everyone. Like I'm 2 degrees from Neil Gaiman. Like it's of course I know people who know Neil Gaiman. I don't know Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, he lives 20 minutes from me.
I know. For a decade, I lived 20 minutes down the road. I knew the people who, like, the stores he'd go into. Like, I knew some of those people who worked at those stores. Like, it doesn't mean anything. I don't, you know, I never found a way to monetize that. Why didn't I become best friends with Neil Gaiman? Why did I miss all these opportunities?
Well, anyway, I'm going
John
to
Barrowman's sister was my mom's college advisor.
Well, Trey's
That's
having
true.
This existential crisis.
That is
I'm
true.
I'm going to take
he
us back and
famous
say that
yet at the time.
We have lots of reason to be excited for the King Killer Chronicle adaptation.
But you know what? A lot of these missed opportunities were at conventions. And the convention scene has been a growing, changing thing. But really, over the last 5 years, and this is me transitioning to the new story for those of you not paying attention to our segues. Over the last few years, there's been a massive, massive push in the convention world, especially in the pop culture events. Those have been the most noticeable. But a lot of us have been asking, is this really a sustainable market as, you know, Wizard World creeps into every, you know, town, more and more convention promoters keep showing up and trying to make new events, and like eventually fandom is a finite resource. There are only so many people to go to so many shows and only so many dollars you can take out of people, and it looks like at least on the pop culture conventions that like to call themselves Comic Cons, much to the chagrin of people looking for an actual comic book convention, it looks like that bubble might actually be breaking.
It's getting there.
The first big thing is Wizard World. We've talked a lot about Wizard World over the past couple years, and most notably because they like lost $4.3 million in 2015, and they massively scaled back their operations for 2016 and 2017. They had a CEO resign, and Wizard World put out a financial statement about a week ago that pretty much said they're broke. They were going to run out of cash for their current operations. Now, since then, one of their board members effectively chipped in a couple of million of his own dollars to keep the company afloat. But before that, other people were trying to Jerick Media Holdings literally put out a press release how they want to buy Wizard World.
Like, jeez. Oh,
like, they literally put out a press release saying, we want to buy this other company, like, out of the blue. And so there's a lot of concern about people trying to buy Wizard because, you know, it might lose its integrity. I'm the man who laughs at his own jokes. But things have been really bleak for the company. And it's not just that. It's the Amazing Conventions who run like Amazing Las Vegas Comic Con, and they run an event in Hawaii, canceled the Amazing Arizona Comic Con and the Amazing Houston Comic Con. Amazing Arizona was supposed to take place in February, and while their notes like blame the current social climate, at this point, this close to the convention, I really don't think, you know, which social climate is code for the election. I really don't think it really has to be a larger financial issue that caused the cancellation. There's no way that, you know, this could be. So they're scaling back to just their Hawaii and Las Vegas shows. They're canceling both the Houston and Arizona shows. And it's really clear to me, at least, that, you know, that it's a major market saturation. We've seen, like the failed launch of RewindCon, this month, last month technically. It's December now, right? I'm not crazy. It's December in early November. We saw the implosion of RewindCon, and now it's coming. And I'm going to write an article about this tomorrow. But since I'm going to upload this Monday morning today, I guess if you're listening to this, RewindCon has reportedly not paid all of their guests. And the owner of RewindCon has personally filed for bankruptcy. It's crazy, but RewindCon completely imploded. Your MiniCon botched their launch of their conventions and ended up folding up altogether. UmiCon Daytona, but it's not just the pop culture events. Let's be really clear. This is not just pop culture events that are seeing problems. Like, UmiCon Daytona folded up because of financial issues. Tsukoshikon, which ran multiple anime cons, including Anime Southwest, Louisville Anime Weekend, Tsukoshikon, they have folded up all of their conventions and shut down their company. And at least, you know, you can't tell me that at least some of those events weren't profitable for a while. But it's like... They've completely ceased operation. It's, I know of other anime cons that I'm not going to name that missed their financial targets. And while it's true that there are conventions that are growing, you know, it's like there are conventions that are doing very well right now. GeekCon in Madison, DaishoCon are the first two I can think of off the top of my head, which, you know, have been growing. I know GeekCon for a fact has been doing very, very well. And expanding their things, but we've seen time and time again. Like, look at Titletown comic and something that completely imploded before they ever happened. So that, you know, the convention never happened. TCE2, I think, is what they called the Titletown Comic and Entertainment Expo or something. I just remember the runner Denny Toll's name, it's. Like, we've seen this time, like, the market is, there's a glut in the market. There are a lot of conventions. And I think we're going to be reaching a point over the next year or two where a lot of these events, and maybe I'm wrong, where a lot of these events are going to fold. And the only conventions that are going to make it through are the ones that have built a solid recurring community. The community-based events are going to, I think, survive. Like, you take an event like, I'll use GeekCon as the example, but even like something bigger like Anime Central, you know, that's a 25,000 person convention. I think
that's been there so long. That's never going to fail. I wouldn't say never.
But my point is that there is but you can go large. I'm just talking like to get a scope of, you know, from like the, like GeekCon's a medium sized convention. ASEN's a large convention for the Midwest at least. Like those conventions, I think will be around because they've worked out a steady growth. They are, you know, but the fact is that a lot of these pop-up shows, which cater to, you know, what is that, like the Anime Con audience or the Gaming Con audience, like with Gen Con in Indianapolis, like these are audiences that, like, or if you go like, say Hoosier Con in Indianapolis, just to, you know, get a small con that's not in Wisconsin, like these shows will survive because they develop communities. And they are very community-focused, whether they're large or whether they're small, about dedicated people to a genre that can be pulled in. And even GeekCon, with its multi-genre focus, will pull in these people, like, will pull in repeat visitors who, like, that becomes their thing. But I think these pop culture shows are just going to, like, SDCC will stay. And then, you know, some of the big stuff on the coast, but a lot of these regional pop culture shows put on by these companies looking to make a quick buck are going to die out because there's only so many times you can get Ernie Hudson's autograph.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a lot of these shows have similar guests. Like, it's RewindCon was interesting because it had a whole bunch of guests who you don't often see, but it also was an incredibly expensive thing to run. And they failed with an attendance that, like, if you can't make money on a 2000 attendee con, you have, on your first year, you have poorly managed your funds.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just be clear. That is management's fault at that point. because the people showed up. Enough people showed up. It wasn't because realistically, most cons aren't going to get a, you know, a 5-digit attendance figure to start with. You know what I mean? It's any first year con should be happy with a 4-digit attendance number and should be prepared for it. And like, if you're in a major city, if you can't be profitable or at least break even with a 4-digit attendance figure, you have poorly planned a first year convention. I'm just saying it. It's like, but I think these pop culture mega shows are going to die, or at least go back to what they used to be, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, and I can see that. I'm not even sure what else to add. Like, yeah, it's just this market has just been so flooded, and everyone wants in on the geek scene, because right now we're... geek culture is popular for one reason or another, you know.
Geek culture has become pop culture.
Mm-hmm. It's the same thing now.
Yeah.
And for better or for worse, like, that's going to get some people excited. But I don't think it's going to be... like, I've talked to people who, like, went to Wizard World Madison, who are at my work, at my warehouse. You know, they're not the kind of people who go to cons regularly. But, like, they went to that one because maybe they wanted to see David Tennant or something.
Right.
But it's not like it's going to be something they're going to regularly do.
So that's the whole thing, is it's like the reason why conventions can be successful long term, like the old school stuff, is because you get dedicated people to the medium. You know, it's like, you know, and even though geek culture has become pop culture, the fact is a lot of people are casual consumers. It's, there have always been casual consumers.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Right, no, absolutely. But... it's my parents who introduced me to Star Trek and Doctor Who would never consider themselves geeks. They would never go to a convention. It's, as I said many times before, my parents watch every episode of Doctor Who, but they don't watch it with any more intensity than they watch The Good Wife. You know what I mean? Like, as that's my go-to example. I mean, they'll admit that Doctor Who's a better show than The Good Wife, but, like, they tune in, and that's it. And so they're done with the program when they're done watching the program. And, you know, it's like, we're going to watch the Doctor Who Christmas special over Christmas, but I'm going to be the one going on the internet arguing about 10 things about Stephen Moffat's writings. They are going to go eat lunch. You know what I mean? It's so, right. But what happens is that as there are more casual viewers of this thing, it's the convention marketers are trying to target more fans because they see more fans as more money, but they don't understand that while the geeky thing has become popular, it's the people who consume like geeks are the same percentage. You know what I mean? It's the people who consume the media in a way that necessitates a convention, the people who want to dress up, the people who want to spend 3 hours in panels discussing these things, like, that is just a percentage. And it's cool that the stuff that we love this much is become mainstream enough because we get more of it. You know what I mean? It's like, think about how many science fiction and superhero movies and all that stuff that we get to consume now because more people like it, and that's awesome.
The Avengers method of telling a story is not like, before that movie came out, no one knew how that was going to happen. Now the idea of a cinematic universe is just standard now.
Right.
And it's tiring. I think that's the other thing too. I mean, you look at how much is coming out going off of that, Nick, the Avengers method of storytelling. You look at how many films are coming out over the next even 2 years. People, you have to budget money out at this point to go and keep, like, you can't just go
to
and
keep
see
up with the stories you like. Yeah.
You can't just go and see Doctor Strange. I mean, you can on its own.
You can see Doctor Strange on its own. That one actually stands alone really well.
But you're going to miss out on other parts of it, too, if like, let's say down the road you want to be like, oh, well, I want to see Avengers Part 3. Well, everything is leading into Avengers Part 3, which means you're going to need to see 5 other movies.
Yeah.
And who has time to just hammer out 5 movies, like, within, you know, it's a tiring thing having to do this to keep up with it.
I don't know. It's only like 2 to 3 a year.
Not over the next 2 years. I think I read something like over the next 2-3 years, there's 18 superhero movies coming out.
No. I was saying if you just want to follow the Avengers.
Oh, gotcha.
You know what I mean? I'm like, I'm not saying like it. That's what's going to happen is that we're going to get like that's DC's challenge is getting people to hook in the way people have hooked in because they've already dedicated like years to the Marvel movies. But
I was thinking about that even with like the Arrowverse. Like, it's I love the Arrowverse right now.
Yeah,
but
Arrow's so tiring though.
But trying to keep up with all of like just watching that TV special they did with the 4-part crossover. It was great. It was a sugar rush. Trying to follow that if I hadn't been watching all of these shows for the last few years would be impossible.
Well, it's actually though this season is a really good season to get into Arrow. I feel like so it's Krista. And I started watching Arrow during the first season, and we stopped. I later went back and watched it all and caught up because I loved when The Flash came on, we decided to give, the Berlanti shows another try. And I loved The Flash. And then, obviously, Supergirl is my favorite show on television right now. So, like, I love Supergirl so much. And The Flash, like, and so I went in and I watched all of Arrow. And I caught myself up and... mostly because also that I knew the John Constantine episode was going to come and I wanted to like be caught up when I got to see John Constantine again. I decided this season, like I was watching the season. I was like, this is probably a really good stepping in point. Like I just need to, I need to explain a couple of things because she had like had enough vague familiarity with the Arrow characters from the Flash crossovers before, because she was able to understand the Flash crossovers fine with the Arrow cast. And so it's, we caught her up this season. So I will say that they did make a really good stepping in point for Arrow. You know, I will say with that 4-part crossover, it's, I spent half the time going, where the fuck is Jax?
I did too. Yeah. Like, I still loved it.
It was especially during the Legends of Tomorrow episode that I was like going, like, I understood him not being like, not focusing on him during the Arrow or the Flash episodes, but it was the Legends of Tomorrow episode. I'm going, where the hell's Jax? And like,
that's fair.
So I was like, and also like the end of the crossover, that scene with like Barry and Oliver sitting in a bar, and I'm going like, this is Legends of Tomorrow, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'll give you the. I mean, that was kind of a weird choice. I still really liked the multi-part crossover.
I enjoyed the multi-part crossover. I wish they had effectively given it another 45 minutes and really started it in the Supergirl episode, because I feel like some of the conclusion was a little rushed. Like I feel like they introduced stuff with that one guy who was in both the 1950s and the current timeline portion, but I really don't felt like any of it like landed.
No, that's fair. However, the Legend of Tomorrow part had the best joke of the entire crossover.
Yes, that was a phenomenal joke. There is no disagreement. That was I'm super happy with that crossover. I thought it was really solid. And I think actually that
it's way better than I have any hope of Justice League being. Yeah. Sorry, I'm still on that.
I don't know. I love the fact that is The Flash the only show without a gay lead?
Lead, yeah. Because the captain of the police force is gay, but
yeah, but he is, I he mean, is but he
he's
still
not
there?
A lead.
Is he still there? I thought he was replaced with what's his name?
Oh yeah, I'm not sure if Singh is still there. Okay, yeah, I'm not sure,
because they've got that other character, the guy played by the guy who was on Heroes and Alias and 90% of all J.J. Abrams projects.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him in Felicity. He had a thing for the Pink Ranger. I just can't remember his name. He was the cop on... like, I remember all of his character names. I just can't remember the actor's name. But anyways, yeah, on Supergirl, we've got Alex Danvers. On Arrow, we've got Mr. Terrific, Curtis. And then we've got Sarah Lance as the, I guess they're going with gay now, because based on the comment in the 100th episode of Arrow, I had been assuming that she was bisexual only because she had the previous romantic relationship with Oliver.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, I feel like there's a bad TV writing trope with characters who go, like, there are no bisexuals. Like,
I think that I haven't written her off as not bisexual. I just feel I think that they've been trying to play up her. God, there's no good way of phrasing this. I'm so sorry.
Her homosexuality.
I think they're trying to play up her homosexuality because, especially right now, I think it's more important than ever to have that.
Right.
I
feel like you could do that while still portraying her as a bisexual. But I, you know, it's like I understand that there are some people who like. There are people who, in their own, you know, story of self-discovery, would have opposite sex relationships who are, you know, exclusively same-sex attracted, you know, while figuring themselves out. So it's not that, like, her story doesn't make sense. It's just that it really wasn't clear until, like, in the 100th episode where she explicitly said to the simulation of her sister that she was just into girls. Like, I think that's the first time it's been explicit.
I thought she said she was more into girls, not
Oh,
just
yeah,
into
that's
girls.
True. That's true. But I think it's nice that the lead superhero on a show in prime time, the debate isn't, is the character gay? It is, how gay is the character? Like, can we be happy about that? Like, I don't know. It's although the actress who plays Sarah Lance, don't get me wrong, I like her a lot as an actress, but she has the same problem that the male lead on Blindspot has, where she can't move half her face. It's like a physical thing. Like, I've met people like this. Like, you ever watch the guy who plays Kurt Weller on Blindspot? Like, he cannot move his face. He has one expression. He moves his mouth and grunts a lot. I'm gonna go over here now. All right. But he can't move his cheeks. Like, she can't, like, she's got, like, one half expression, and then, like, she can smile a little. Fortunately, she's vocally expressive enough as an actress where, like, I actually still really like her in the role. But it's this thing that bugs me when I see people's face and then I notice it.
I got nothing.
It's this, like, it's this frozen face thing that, like, there are just some people out there that have it, and they make it makes me, like, it's this uncanny valley with a real human being. I don't know. It's, you know, the funny thing is that, so, like, to go back to the actual story about these pop culture conventions,
right,
is that Stephen Amell literally just started an agency this last year, being effectively, like, four actors going to conventions. And, like, because the money has been so big, but the fact is that, like, that money's going to go away.
Right.
Because, again, it goes down to the fact that once you've met David Tennant? Once you've met Steve Amell or David Tennant for the first time and you paid so much money and you got the autograph.
Did you just get both of my man crushes mixed up or what?
I don't know. I would love to meet David Tennant's underachieving younger brother who owns a shop in Westchester.
But anyways, isn't Westchester in New York?
Yeah, he's
that's
he
where the X-Men
lives in
live?
America, dude. I don't mean to say underachieving, different life path. Yeah, he moved to America and now owns like a Quick Stop. Okay, it's
all right.
Different.
So, but my point is that
different life goals, guys.
Once you've spent all the money to take your photo with Steve Amell, get the autograph, see him talk for 20 minutes. A lot of people don't
$600.
Well, you've spent all this money and you have your stuff. Like you've had that experience. You have the signature. You don't need it a second time from the same guy, right? Mm. Like, it's there. I mean, yes, there are people who will do it every single time, especially for like the guy who plays Daryl Dixon on The Walking Dead. He's got dedicated fans who apparently are trying to bite him,
want to eat him. Yeah,
yeah. And people wonder why he keeps canceling conventions. It's like, yeah, there are some people, but it's not enough to sustain an industry because so many people like, and yeah, you can cycle in new guests, and yeah, you can maybe get some of those people a second time. But the fact is that pop culture is a finite resource with the number of people you can bring in. And as I said at the beginning of this segment, there's only so many times you're willing to pay for Ernie Hudson's autograph.
Also, there's no telling when, like, especially with current shows, when the bubble on that is going to burst. Like, I'm of the understanding that Walking Dead has been hemorrhaging viewership recently, so...
Well, most shows do when they run this long.
Mm-hmm.
It's still...
Especially when it's... Especially when a show just, like The Walking Dead thrives on upsetting viewers. Yeah, there you go. That's... I was going to say misery porn. That's what I was going to say.
No, it's much more misery porn than torture porn.
Okay.
That's probably what I meant to say. The whole thing with the end of last season with... I'm not going to spoil it for people who are watching, like, a season behind on Netflix or something. With a major character death, like, how graphic it was in the scene shows. Like, yes, those were... But those were far more graphic than they usually are on that show. You know what I mean? Like, that was specifically meant to be a more graphic scene than what you're used to seeing, and they're not going to stay that graphic because then it would lose the impact the few times they do it. Because they killed my favorite character on the goddamn show, and I'm really angry. I haven't watched last week's episode yet, or this week's episode at the time we're recording it, because this week's episode is currently airing. Fear the Walking Dead has actually been really solid.
I hear that's a better show.
I don't know if it's better. You know what it is, though, is it's like Walking Dead, like those seasons that people talk about how slow they are, bad they are, they watch really well on binge watching, like if you're watching two or three episodes at a time. So, because it's like, you take, like, second season of Walking Dead is notoriously slow. Like, they change showrunners because of it. And I really liked it, but I also watched it on Netflix, where I could watch three episodes at a time or four episodes at a time on a Saturday. And so, for me, those scenes went really fast. This is the same thing with Lost. Like, I watched the first five seasons of Lost all... like on Netflix before like the sixth season aired. And so like people talk about like how slow certain parts of it were. And like those parts didn't seem slow to me because I watched them again, like in sessions of binge watching. And so like it's really interesting how that works out. And I've also had the converse experience where stuff that like upon a rewatch, like I've been rewatching Burn Notice just for the heck of it, because it's a fun show and it's something to watch while I'm doing other stuff. Because
and
when you
Bruce Campbell.
Yeah, he's... Oh, man, that reminds me. I need to catch up on Ash versus Walking... Ash versus Evil Dead. Ash versus Walking Dead. I would watch Ash...
I would watch
Walking,
the hell
Walking
out of
Dead.
Ash versus Walking Dead.
I would watch
I
the shit out of that.
Show.
But anyways, it's like... There's stuff that I remember like being these really long arcs that were done in like... two episodes or three episodes, because when I watched them live, you know, there was like a week between each episode and not like the 20-second auto load screen. You know what
right.
I mean? So I think it's a different experience. And so a lot of like people have been talking about how this season, like the current season of The Walking Dead has been very slow. And it's mostly because we're bouncing between like three different locations. Like, and so we're getting the concurrent story of what was, you know, of this time period of what happened here, and then what happened here during that time, and what happened here during that time. And so it, like, the time frame is moving slowly. But I'm sure that, like, if the guy who decides to pick up Walking Dead, like, or who takes some time off and then decides to catch up is going to watch those, and suddenly it's all going to feel really fresh to them. So it's really hard. I don't know. Best television I've watched in a while was The Gilmore Girls. That new season's really good. Not enough conventions invite the cast members of Gilmore Girls. I want to see Scott Patterson at the next Wizard show. God damn it.
You're not going to go to it anyway.
I know. Because I refuse to pay money for autographs.
I think we've kind of gone off the rails at this point.
We have. And as going off the rails, we should try to be better people instead. Speaking of trying to be better people, for
Yes. Sorry, I don't have this story up because I thought Trey was doing it. I didn't realize we assigned this to me at the beginning of the episode.
We did. You specifically said, hey, I can
you
do that story.
It.
You specifically requested this story.
Somebody else that has in front of them. I don't have the press release in front of me.
So do you like giving people to things? What?
What?
I don't have it up either. Because I thought Fur was doing it.
Just a second.
All right.
Oh,
so
geez.
Now
this is this.
I don't even live near the.
So
Twin
okay.
Cities.
So we know a lot of our listeners live in the Twin Cities. It's just a fact.
Massive
as,
proportion
as
of
we radiated out from
of our
Northwestern
group
Wisconsin. So
you
know,
and her so, wanting to give money to things.
Okay. So actually, so what's happening right now is that Twin Cities Geek is running a grassroots holiday toy and book drive in the Twin Cities. And they're working with about 30 different retailers. And they've been running this for a couple of weeks, and it's going through December 15th. They're asking for new and gently used items donated to go towards families served by the Hallie Q. Brown Community Center, which is a nonprofit social service agency in the Summit University area of St. Paul, and the Women's Prison Book Project, a national effort based out of the Seward neighborhood in Minneapolis that provides female and transgender inmates with free reading materials. There are about 30 businesses working with them. If you go to TwinCitiesGeek.com, TwinCitiesGeek.com, you can find more information about where you can donate things, about where you can give. And it's a very good cause. It's really simple. And if you were planning on donating toys this year, don't give it to the Salvation Army. Give it here if you're in the
yes.
cities. Like give it to this, this toy drive, because this is a really good organization. You know, the Hallie Q. Brown Community Center it's a great organization, and it's good people. And if you're gonna be giving, and you're in the Twin Cities, and you can, you know, go in and do it, just go in and do it there. And that's,
I agree.
You know, Trey took the words right out of my mouth. It
literally
was
because
of my tongue,
Fur was supposed to be
I'm
the one
sure
to tell you
it was.
This.
And
Fur being
I
the person who spends the
Trey,
most time in the Twin Cities.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. All of that word for word.
Oh, my God.
Dear Lord. So, yes. All
right. Anyway.
You should give if you can. And, I'm sure you look, we're
support.
A bunch of geeks. You've got books sitting there that you've read once. It's sitting on your shelf. You've read it. You're never going to read that book again, most likely, but you liked it. Give it so someone else can read it.
Mm-hmm. Share the love. Get some books out to people.
Yeah. It's, you know, do you really need, give away that copy of American Gods. And if you decide to read again, go buy another copy. You know, Neil Gaiman needs the money.
Wait, sure he does. Okay, yeah.
But
okay.
At this point, though, we should probably move on to the mailbag.
Yeah, let's see what we got. We've got one letter in the mailbag this week. Pulling it up from our old buddy, the Mad Chemist. And his subject is All the Anger. Oh, boy.
He said he was mad.
Hi, all. I hope that all three of you are well. I'm writing to share a link that Nick may be interested in. And yes, I have seen this.
We'll toss the link up in the show notes.
Long story short, the Odaiba Gundam Front 1-1 scale RX-78-2 Gundam from the original Mobile Suit Gundam series, the 1-to-1 scale reconstruction of it in Odaiba is coming down after being up for several years.
Yeah.
Yes, I really should have shared something about this on even just Nick Azumi's own like page about it. It's heartbreaking for me. The 1-1 scale Gundam was really cool. I'm sad I didn't get to see it in person. It's coming down of March of 2017, and unless I am going to Japan sometime before then, I'm going to miss out on it, which makes me kind of sad. It was probably the coolest. I mean, here's the thing. There have been, maybe I shouldn't say shocking, but a lot of anime robots have been memorialized, or at least, or if not memorialized, you know, given some really cool statues and various places across Japan for one reason or another, including there's an enormous Gigantor out there, Tetsujin 28 for you purists. There's a bronze Astro Boy in the same park where there's a bronze Lum from Urusei Yatsura. That's kind of cool. But Gigantor Space Age Robot powers at your hands. But I mean, bigger the 1-1 Gundam was
taller than, sorry.
Okay. But I mean, the 1-1 Gundam was really cool. They did a lot of neat things with it. They you know, aside from it being a 1-1 Gundam, some of the vents on it actually shot steam. There was a while where they had it with its beam saver in its hand. There was a little video screen of Amuro Ray sitting in the cockpit for a while. It was really neat.
Well, and so, just yeah. Gundams are such a large scale. You know, a lot of other robots series like aren't that big. Like Gundams mm-hmm. are huge. Like, I mean, the only thing really bigger is if someone like built a 1-to-1 scale Eva.
And it's hard to do a 1-to-1 scale Eva because the scale of the Eva changes depending on what episode you're watching.
Yeah, and it's
really inconsistent.
And you got to make sure
that.
The armor stays powered or else the thing inside escapes. Don't crawl into your mom. That's still what I'm saying.
Yeah, the Gundam stands at 18 meters. The original Gundam stands at 18 meters tall, for those who are curious. And while that's like standard size for a Gundam, that's not the tallest one. The new Gundam and the Unicorn are even larger.
They should put up like some of the ones from Gundam Wing. Those look cool.
That would bring in a lot of American tourists, and I wouldn't say the Japanese fans would be indifferent, but that show is so much bigger over here than it was.
Well, I was just saying because the Gundams look cooler.
I don't know. I like my mecha semi-realistic, which is probably
there's nothing
why I love
realistic about mecha.
Semi-realistic. That's why I like I Pat Labor's and Votoke.
Just
so
put up
much.
A pink Zaku instead.
Actually, Shuichi Ikeda, who played Char Aznable, campaigned for that. He said at one press event that he was rather jealous of Amuro. In that regard, he would like to see his mobile suit get represented.
It, also, it's pink. It's red. No, it's fucking pink. Light red.
But anyway, going back to Mad Chemist's letter, if this is true, it's a sad day for all that won't be able to see it. I find it amusing that I stumped Trey on what his nerd rage was last time. I agree with you guys about not being thrilled with the Ghost in the Shell movie. I hope that we can raise our voices and change the racism in Hollywood someday. I want to believe that we can. I'm not super optimistic right now, personally. That's me.
Everything is terrible, and nothing will ever be okay.
Maybe not nothing will ever be okay, but it's
you know,
be a
there's
while
the motto of my other blog: everything is terrible right now, and it's probably going to get worse.
Get worse. 4-year racist shit show. Anyway, I'm not looking forward to the next few years. Anyway, I would like to raise this question. Channel your inner crotchety Miyazaki. I've been looking forward to this one. What things do you see in the anime, manga, or manga industry right now that make you angry and you see as problems?
The entire industry is now catering to an otaku fan base that exclusively wants, like, sexy women anime and all that shit, when I really just want, like, gritty... Like, not necessarily gritty, but, like, I want Pat Labor. I want more Pat Labor. Like,
there
that
actually
flavor.
There actually is a new Pat Labor in pre-production.
Well, no,
right
but what I mean is, that, like, no, no, sorry, what I mean is, that. like, that general, like, that era of anime. Like, yeah, there was a lot of garbage out there, too, but, like, you know, the I want my sex comedies to be like Rumiko Takahashi sex comedies, not the like the new stuff. I don't want, you know what I mean? Like,
it's weird that I know what you're talking about, because there's stuff that Urusei Yatsura and Ranma can do that I think is hilarious, that when modern shows try to do it, it just doesn't work.
Well, it feels exploitive, and I think it really comes down to the voice of the writer. Like, it's... I mean, like, let me tell you, there's problematic stuff in Ranma and, like, in Urusei Yatsura,
oh, hell
to go
yeah.
back. It's, I'm not going to pretend that it's... But I feel like there's...
I'm
like,
not saying that there isn't either.
Right, it's... I feel like things are either end up being... And I think it's because, frankly, just the anime industry has become less profitable. And so it's like, I feel like you get a bunch of stuff that's either a cheap cash grab like Crystal, or you get stuff that is boobs ahoy. Like,
well,
I understand
that
Kill la Kill is supposed to have an interesting story, but I just can't get past the character design. And so I never watched it.
I'm eventually going to give that one a second chance, because one of my really militant feminist friends really wants me to watch it. So,
you know what it is it's like... I can believe someone that the story's good, but the fact is that it was still animated by male animators for a male audience to jerk off to. Let's not put any pretensions otherwise is to, you know, like the anime that I love is often stuff that was never really popular when it came out, though. So maybe I'm not like, but the problem is that because Cowboy Bebop has this massive legacy, but when it originally aired, like, none of those were popular decisions.
But you're asking for stuff from the era that you're asking for, though, Trey, was that big. You're asking for things from the bubble, especially from the OVA bubble, the late 80s when people would throw money at pretty much any project, no matter how no matter how experimental it was, you're never going to get Detonator or Gun in this day and age.
Right. It's
you're
the problem
never going
is
to
that
get...
the industry shrank. It's mm-hmm. as the industry has shrunk. It's what happens is that there's always like all that's left are people going for the cash grab. There's no experimentation, and there can't be experimentation because there's no money to do the experimentation.
You're not going to get Orgun. You're not going to get Bubblegum Crisis anymore.
I'm not going to get Serial Experiments Lane. Mm-hmm. You know, it's. And that's, you know, I had the opportunity to at least be a growing nerd in the 90s is when I got into anime, and, like, it was this exciting experimental thing, and I lament not getting more series in those veins that I appreciated so much, like, and I understand why I can't get them more. You know, it's, you can't get the fringe if you don't have the mainstream, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like, you need a popular mainstream to allow that fringe to be possible, and so if the high-selling stuff isn't high-selling at all, then you don't get the cool stuff happening on the edge. It's just, it's a matter of, you know, it's a bell curve. There's always going to be stuff in the middle that is, you know, the super popular, but the higher that bell curve, the more room there is on the edge. And so it's, and, like, there is stuff that I've enjoyed that's been mainstream. You know, it's, yes, I know Attack on Titan has massively fascist undertones and sometimes overt messages in it, but overall as an action series, that first season was very enjoyable. You know what I mean?
It's pretty solid for Zeta Gundam without robots.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, no,
sorry,
no, I'm fine with something. You know, it's honestly, most series rely on, like, in a previous episode of Nerd and Tie, I talked about the three-man team permeating so much of low budget science fiction and even high budget science fiction. With, you know, the hero, the suit, and the flat love interest, and how that, like, even goes into, like, the first season of The Flash. Like, shows that are great can sometimes fall into that. Like, we all know that there's similar, like, there are other tropes, like the five-man team, where people can draw similarities between two different shows, and so often. And so, yes, there's always going to be some level of creative recycling, because there's a finite number of unique stories that can be told in many ways. And so, yeah,
go ahead.
But I was just to wrap up my little ramble here and just kind of, you know, put a point on it. It's what I'm disappointed about in the modern anime is just that the anime industry has shrunk to a point where I can't get the content I want because there's no money to make it.
I guess I have two things. One thing I want to say building off of Trey's, and then I have my own answer to this one, but on Trey's point, one of our listeners at Nerd and Tie Expo, actually one of our artists at Nerd and Tie Expo, was asking me what shows I was into from this last season. Because I still watch anime, but a lot of the modern stuff I have had trouble getting into. The only show I was keeping up with last season was Macross Delta. I mean, you know, it's not even anything new. It's the same larger meta storyline that I was into when I first got into anime. So, I don't know what that's... I think that says a lot about where the industry's
now. You know what I've been watching lately? I've been, and it's is my wife and I every week watch a couple episodes of the old Sailor Moon.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, we've been watching the new dub and, you know, occasionally watching episodes that never aired in the U.S. And, that's it.
And that's aged pretty well, I still think.
Oh, God, no, it's so good. It's so good.
Which actually builds off of my other answer that I want to say, things that are bothering me in the modern anime industry. Yes. I'm frustrated that so many light novels that aren't complete are getting 13-episode adaptations that are essentially just advertisements for light novels, and the actual animated version of the story is never going to get finished. That drives me up the damn wall.
Yeah.
But my biggest pet peeve right now in the anime industry goes to the magical girl genre. And it also kind of builds off of what you were saying, Trey, that everything is marketing so heavily at otaku. So much of the magical girl genre these days is also heavily trying to get that otaku demographic. And as a result, so many shows in the genre are so skeezy and uncomfortable.
That's the whole thing, is you can never find a mainstream audience if you are you need a mainstream audience to sustain the industry. It's the Marvel movies wouldn't be working right now if they weren't for the fact that everyone and their dog goes and sees them. You know what I mean? It's that they...
Yeah.
But the fact is, like, let's look at American comics have this exact same problem, that it's been a shrinking market because they spent 20 years marketing towards the same fans and exclusively going to them. And that's why it's been such, like, a change. Digital comics, and then, like, in the last few years, the inclusion of more female characters in less porny, art styles have really kind of been the only savior for print comics.
We see the same thing in magical girl anime in the post Nanoha era. And I lay a lot of the blame on the series Lyrical Nanoha, has been this just super exploitative, super porny transformation sequences. And for that matter, like, we look at things like Nanoha that had like full frontal third grader transformations.
Yeah. It's just my wife commented, gross. Like, we're watching the old Sailor Moon, and my wife commented that the transformations felt a little like fan servicey. I'm like, you have not seen fan service.
I was going to say, original Sailor Moon is tame. It's so tame by comparison.
Right, I'm like, no.
And you look at things like Sailor Moon or Cardcaptor Sakura, what was that? Sorry, I got...
Well, I was just saying, it's same up. For even the time period that it came out in, too. Like, it's...
Like,
it's just
you
the
look
difference
at
is you wouldn't put that shit in a kid's show.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, look at Sailor Moon. Look at Cardcaptor Sakura and how focused on being, like, these characters as positive role models and trying to build these up for... It's partly an escapism thing for little girls of, I can be super powerful and I can be frilly at the same time. That's so neat. And then you compare it to so many of these modern magical girl shows, even good examples like Madoka Magica or this season's Matoi, fall back so heavily on these really porny tropes and making me super uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And like, outside of the Pretty Cure series, you basically cannot find magical girl anime that are actually aimed at little girls. And I know that's a weird problem for a 27-year-old American man to have, but it's a legitimate problem.
Well, no, it's a problem for the industry, though, because if you don't have those kid viewers, you don't have money for the studio. It's when you target this older demographic that is exclusively male demographic, yes, that's some quick bucks that can be made on merchandise, but the fact is you can't ever build a large enough franchise to ever fund more stuff. It's Sailor Moon was successful because it targeted kids.
The girls going back to Sailor Moon now were fans when they were kids. That's
right.
Not like...
So that's... Ugh. That's... Yeah, it... I think we've complained a lot about this, and I think we're not going to fix it, and I think we're running to the long end of the episodes here, so
yeah, sorry about that, but that's been my personal pet peeve, is just the magical girl genre it's not entirely dead yet, but it's pretty damn close.
As we're coming up on the unofficial time limit of episodes that I set, well, no, it's no episode should run longer than an hour and 36 minutes, and we're almost at an hour and a half here. Exactly. Okay. So it's
sorry, I drifted off for half an hour.
So we're going to move on to the our final segment in every episode.
Sakura sequel, please don't suck. Sorry.
We're moving on to the Vomit Hat Steve Challenge. And the Vomit Hat Steve Challenge is part of the show where I read a line from a book every episode. And the challenge to you, our listeners, is to guess what book I am reading from. If you guess the book correctly, you get included in the Hall of Awesome. The benefits of the Hall of Awesome are as follows. You get listed on the website. We say your name here on the episodes. That's it. The current members of the Hall of Awesome are as follows. Archimide, Zero, Rene Nascenti, Cheesy McDamu, Krista, Slithery D, The Shameless Otaku, The Random Ramblings Man, Corfan, Capito, Chris Graham, Lilysaurus, Paper Godzilla, Cavsey, The Minnesota Librarians, and Sean Orange. And we are going to continue our current book that I've been reading for a while. And this is your line for this episode. The magician is here. He is here. What can he want? If you know what book that's from, go to nerdandtie.com/contact and tell us. Or if you have anything else you'd like to say, you know, ask Nick about what his real opinions are about anime, why exactly that I am still losing my hair, or what Fur plans to do with his life in a post-Nerdentie world, send them our way. Let us know. Let us hope. Let us pray. Let us sit together at the sea of life, burning forward in our passions.
Wow.
Sure, why not?
Follow your dreams, follow your hearts. Don't get on that airplane. The psychic said so. Oh, and this thing's being stupid. Anyways, so with that, we should wrap up this episode of Nerd and Tie. Remember, you can always subscribe to us on iTunes and the Google Play Store and any other place where healthy podcasts are sold, like Stitcher. And I am, of course, Trey Dorn.
I am and forever shall be Nick Izumi.
I'm for sirs.
And remember, folks, no matter what your hopes, no matter what your dreams, no matter what you think, things could always be worse, things could always be better, things will always be in a state that they were not now but will be later but cannot be yet ever truly again. And we love you and all of your pants.
Keep on spocking in the free world.
And remember, in your heart, in your soul, it's always a dance party. Always be dancing. Never not be silent, still, curious, uncurious.
Dance like no one is watching.
Murder people who say cliches like dances no, like nobody's watching.
I don't know who said that, man.
Or don't murder people. Weird. Don't murder people. In fact, that's just a general rule. Don't murder anyone. That's our challenge for you for the next 2 weeks. Don't murder anyone. And also go to GoFundMe.com/nerdandtie and give to our legal defense fund. Because, frankly, we could really use your help right now.
Today is the first day of the rest of your life, Liadama.
Except for it's not. Because you're not Liadama. That's a made-up name from a fake person.
The worst line in an otherwise good
show. If your
parents
have named you Liadama, get new parents.